Before we dive into James and start looking at what it is, I think it's probably worth me pointing out what James isn't. Because James isn't a difficult book of doctrine. It's not that at all. James isn't even a defense of Christianity. It's not even an explanation of how to be saved. If you read James, you'll see it's none of those things. So what is James? Well, simply, it's a letter written to people who are presumed to know the basics of Christianity. And its purpose is to drive home the importance of living out the truth. The thing that prompted James to write is just as relevant for us today. If you say you believe, then why do you live as if you don't? If you say you believe, why do you live as if you don't? Now, I'm not saying that everybody here lives an awful life and we're not distinctively Christian. But actually, James is saying, and I think quite rightly, because all of us are not as distinctively Christian as we can be, he's saying, you've got to live as if you really believe what you say you believe. He says, Christians, you need to be distinctive, but in a good way. Because it's easy for us to be distinctive in a bad way, isn't it? We've got to be distinctive in a good way. So then, who is James? Well, James simply begins saying, James, a slave of God and the Lord Jesus Christ. And this James, well, he is the half-brother of Jesus. He was one of four sons born to Joseph and Mary. And if, as is supposed, they're listed in birth order in Matthew 13, 54 to 56, James turns out to be the oldest and therefore the closest in age to Jesus. So he was child number two. Just imagine your big brother's Jesus. Just imagine this. And you're growing up with Jesus. You're Mary, why can't you be like your brother? What do you think it'd be like to literally have a perfect brother? If you read the New Testament, you'll see that James wasn't a believer until after the resurrection. In fact, you'll see that he thought that Jesus was a complete fruitcake at one point. He wants to have him taken away. Men with white coats to come along and move him on. He wasn't a believer until after the resurrection. But he went on to be thought of as an apostle. You can check that out in 1 Corinthians 15:7. And he became the pastor of the church at Jerusalem. Galatians 1:19 shows us that. James was known for an incredibly deep faith and a profound life of prayer. So that's James. But who is James writing to? Well, on the whole, they will have been Jewish Christians. And there were Jewish Christians who were getting a bit of grief from all the people around. The Gentiles hated them because they were Jews. The Jews hated them because they were Christians. So they were getting a really tough time. But instead of saying, well, there, don't you worry, dear. That's not what James says. He challenges them. He challenges them to rethink their difficulties. And he challenges them to trust God in every difficulty. The thought that becoming a Christian will make life easier would have seemed absolutely bonkers to James. James would have laughed at the idea that becoming a Christian will make all of your problems disappear and that you'll live happily ever after. And if you're ever tempted to tell people about Christ, and I hope you are, that's a great temptation. Don't be tempted to think, well, I'll just tell them it's all going to be, life will be great. You just accept Jesus and all your problems will go away. Because that's not true. In fact, accept Jesus, you put your head above the parapet and the devil's after you. That's not a great evangelistic tool either, but I'm just saying. It's not a happily ever after experience. It's a happily and amazing, joyful eternity. But for the few years on earth, there are difficulties to come. In fact, we'll see James say that it is our response to trials that prove the reality of our faith. Someone once said, and I couldn't find out who it was, but I thought it was a great quote, "Christians are like tea bags. You don't know what's in them until you put them in hot water." It's good, isn't it? I don't think it was Mr. Tetley or Mr. PG, but yeah, could have been anybody. Christians are like tea bags. You don't know what's in them until you put them in hot water. Our challenge today is no different to the people that James first wrote to. I wonder how often we ask, how can I avoid this or that hassle, or how can I get out of this? But James will show us that instead of that question, we ought to be asking, how can I change the way I react to difficult times? The fact is, we cannot avoid trouble. We cannot avoid trials. They will come our way. What we can do, though, is to change the way that we deal with the difficulties that hit us. So what is James' advice? Well, verse 2. "Dear brothers and sisters, when troubles of any kind come your way." Now, if you're one of those awful people, sorry, I shouldn't say that. If you're one of those people who writes in Bibles, circle the word "when" there. Okay? If you're somebody who writes in your Bible, circle the word "when." If it's a church Bible, please don't. But just let the word sink in. James has picked his words really carefully, and James does pick his words really carefully. You need to know that when you're reading what he has written. James has picked his words prayerfully and carefully. He deliberately uses the Greek word hotam, which means when. It means as soon as long as. James says the trouble's not an optional thing. It is going to happen. It's inevitable. Trouble is not optional. It's inevitable. He doesn't say, if trouble comes your way, he says, when. Disciple Peter in his first letter says something similar in 1 Peter 4:12. He says, "Dear friends, don't be surprised at the fiery trials you're going through, as if something strange were happening to you. Now this is the new normal." This is really encouraging, isn't it? But actually, it is encouraging because we need to know that these things will happen. And as Misha was sharing earlier, we need to know that when we come out the other side, and it is amazing when you come out the other side of something, isn't it? And you look back and you see the way that God was working. But you can only do that when you come out the other side. I would say, though, at this point, having majored on the fact that it's kind of when, not if, we would have to be some kind of sadist, wouldn't we, to enjoy the suffering. That is not, we're not supposed to be victims or feeling like victims. Woe is me, I am undone. It's not that. It's not a, you know, some kind of, oh, let's feel sorry for myself again because this is happening. We shouldn't be enjoying it. That would be crazy. There's a bloke called Oswald Chambers, and I think he sums up well. He wrote, "To choose suffering makes no sense at all. But to choose God's will in the midst of our suffering makes all the sense in the world." Anyway, back to James. We'll leave Oswald there. "When trouble of any kind has come your way, consider it an opportunity for great joy." Key phrase, "any kind," there is the Greek poikilos. And it means varied. It means all types. He's not talking about quantity, but variety. It's not the idea that we will have countless troubles, though that too is true. It is the idea that we are going to have all types and all sorts of troubles. Maybe there's the loss of the job. Maybe there's a broken relationship. Maybe there's hassle at work. Maybe there's an early, untimely death of a loved one. Maybe there's a prolonged illness. Maybe there's depression that hangs around like a fog. Maybe there's a child who goes off the rails. Maybe there's an abusive parent. And maybe there are all sorts of other things that I could stand here and list. We all know what it's like, don't we, going through life. All these things will come and hit us. There will be a variety of things. But whatever they are, they can actually threaten to overwhelm us, can't they? They can overwhelm us if we try and deal with them by ourselves. Now, in effect here, what James says is if you're really a Christian, it will show by the way that you deal with trouble. If your faith is no good in times of trouble, then it is just plainly no good. If it's only good for when you need it, then you don't need it. Sorry, if it's only good when you don't need it, then you don't need it. Frankly, faith's easy, isn't it, if your life's going well? Well, actually, no, it's not, because it doesn't exist, probably, if you're in that camp. If it's only good for when you don't need it, then you don't need it. It's a rubbish faith. It's not real. If your faith in God is only good for when you're doing well, then what good is your faith? That's what James says here. I wonder how you feel about that. You see, true faith will hold us up even when things go belly up. The genuineness of our faith is tested by how it holds up when the going gets tough. So James says, just accept that this is the way it'll be. And when you do, when you accept that these things are going to happen, your approach to your life and your faith are going to be coming from a whole different angle. They'll be coming from God's angle. You'll see it God's way. You see, your attitude will shape your outcome. Your attitude to what you're going through will shape the outcome of how you come through it. Now, I don't know about you, but I know that at times in my life I have asked God, why? Why is it that I'm going through this? Why is this happening? However can this be useful? Why, God? Maybe you have to. If so, let me ask, have you really looked for the answer? It's not a bad question, but look for the answer. Because otherwise, what you're doing is just throwing your arms up in disgust, and you're blaming God, and you're getting bitter, and you're getting angry, and you're getting resentful, and just plainly hacked off. Think back to a recent issue, either big or small, that you had to deal with. Something that just wasn't what you wanted. How did you feel about it? How did you react to it? What went through your head? What was your attitude? Anger, frustration, disappointment, failure? Well, look at verse 2 again. And this time, if you're a Bible scribbler, circle the word consider. When troubles of any kind come your way, consider it an opportunity for great joy. The word consider is hegemai. And it is an accounting term, and it means put together or add up, work it out, do the sums, do some thinking, toss it around with God a bit. James doesn't glibly say, always look on the bright side of life. He says, well, respond with a kind of deliberate, intelligent calculation of your situation. Really think about it. Really take some time to work it out with God. He doesn't say your trouble is a great joy. Don't misread that and think that God's some kind of weirdo. That would be odd, wouldn't it? Be weird. He doesn't say that. No, James says we should consider them an opportunity for joy. You see the difference? It is not to enjoy being in trouble, but to live joyfully even when the trouble comes. And if you've never been able to do that, then you can. And it is an amazing witness to people around you as well. When you might be going through stuff, no, you're not going to be enjoying what you're going through, but you can still know God's joy and His peace. It doesn't diminish the pain. But you can still know that. Believers aren't asked to coolly endure a kind of time of testing, but we're to learn from the experience. You see, whilst we focus on the here and now, God has His spotlight on the end results. And God knows just how he intends to use the trouble that you find yourself in. We might not even think that it is possible, but James reminds us here that God can turn every experience to the good. Every experience. But here's the rub. Before he can produce that result, we need to believe that even in the deepest dark valleys, we need not fear the evil. We've got to really hang on to that. God can use every experience to the good. And don't forget, there is no need for fear. And in the tough times, it helps us to remember that we can be certain that God has a promise. Verses 3 and 4. For you know that when your faith is tested, your endurance has a chance to grow. So let it grow. For when your endurance is fully developed, you will be perfect and complete, needing nothing. Knowing that trouble has a purpose doesn't always, but it can make a big difference to how you face the hard times that you're going through. God does not abandon us ever, no matter how we feel. According to James, people being tested, people going through tough times, well, when that happens to us, it brings out certain characteristics. When that happens to people, first they become perfect. Wow. Actually, properly translated, mature, teleos. Not sinless, but spiritually mature, spiritually grown up, not a spiritual toddler. Second, they become entire, meaning whole and complete, fully developed in the Christian experience. And third, they need nothing. That's a big claim, isn't it? They need nothing. Well, that means that they trust God will provide everything they need to stay obedient in their lives of faith. A Christian is not a Christian unless our faith is tested and it's confirmed. But we will naturally, in our kind of natural selves, we will try to avoid being tested. We don't like it when we're tested. Testing is a completely negative idea. In our heads, it's just wrong. But James says it shouldn't be a negative thing for the Christian. See, what James says here isn't just one of his good ideas, isn't just something that James has come up with. It is God's command. And you'll find the whole Bible gives the same advice. But the big thing to get hold of here is that it is not just a little bit of advice. It's not just a good suggestion. It is a command. And it is not a pointless, impossible command. You know, sometimes we're asked to do something that might be really crazy. But it's not pointless. It's not impossible. It's a command that is possible for us to obey. Let me explain. If I said to you, close your eyes. Well, some of you have already done that, so I know that that is something you can actually do. But if I said to you, I tell you what, Brian, why don't you just fly around the room, mate? Do a couple of circuits, will you? And then do a bit of a somersault and land in your seat. Well, it's a command Brian can't follow, isn't it? I mean, as he says, if he could, he would, but he can't. That is a command that is impossible. It's something you can't do, but God's commands to us are always, always possible. God's command here is a command that is possible. But you have to do it yourself. See, our life with God is a partnership. He really does do all the work, but we have to put ourselves in that position where he can do the work. Nobody else, you see, can do it for you. Other people can give you advice. Other people can support you. But when God says to you, this is for you, You have to do it for yourself. We have to make the effort to do it. No one else can do it for us. It has to be a conscious decision that we make. It is not a suggestion. It is a command, and it demands a response. So when it says, when your faith is tested, don't assume it'll always be tested from the outside, from something that hits you, something external, I don't know, like the loss of a job, like the death of a loved one. It can be that, and often these things are external, but it can also be the stuff that is churning around in your head and churning around in your heart. Maybe it was triggered by something that happened, or maybe it's just things from your past or your present that you are not dealing with God. So we can be certain that God has a purpose. Whether it's something that's hitting you from the stuff that you're not dealing with God, whether it's something that hits you from the outside, God has a purpose in it. And in verse 5, we'll see that we need to remember that God doesn't want us to go through testing times alone, all by ourselves. Christians shouldn't go through trials alone. We can and we should use God's wisdom. We should go through it with Him. We should support one another, but we should use His wisdom. Verse 5 says, if you need wisdom, ask our generous God and He will give it to you. He will not rebuke you for asking. This wisdom's not some kind of trendy plan on how to handle life. There are plenty of those out there. It is bigger than that. It's spiritual wisdom. It's delivered by God by way of the Bible and by way of prayer. And that kind of wisdom isn't inbuilt. You know, we've all got brains, we've all got the ability to do things in our heads, but this kind of wisdom isn't inbuilt. Now, that kind of wisdom has to come from asking. That is by praying for God to show us how to move ahead. How to move ahead when the road looks like a death trap. God doesn't promise that the hassle will get sorted in a flash, but He does promise that He will lead us through it, whatever it is. And at some point, He'll use our experiences to bless us and bless others. What is wisdom? Because often it's one of those words that you might kind of throw around, but I tend to think of wisdom as applied knowledge. It is the stuff that you know, that you have prayed about with the Lord, that you have learned from the Bible, that you know in your head, that you actually apply. That's when it becomes wise, because you put it into action. There is no point in having a brain full of stuff if it just sits there. Wisdom is applied knowledge. It's knowledge that is put to use. I think that the most of us get verses 2, 3 and 4 in theory, but how do we put that theory, that knowledge, into practice? What do we do? Do we stay where we are? Or do we move elsewhere? Do we look for a way out? Or do we expect God to sort out the mess where we are without us having to do anything? What do we do? James says, in a situation like that, ask God and He'll let you know what to do. He'll give you the wisdom. He'll show you. He'll let you know how to react in whatever situation you find yourself. You will always be able to count on Him. We're not intended to go through life alone. But so often we do, though, don't we? Because either we don't believe God is interested, or actually we don't properly believe that God is big enough to deal with whatever huge problem we've got. We sort of think that God, you see, this is just too big. How could God do that? How can He sort it out? It's too big even for God. We let our problems overwhelm us rather than letting God be God. Verse 6. When you ask Him, be sure that your faith is in God alone. Do not waver. When you ask Him, be sure that your faith is in God alone. All the way through the Bible, there is that central question facing us, isn't there? Who are you trusting? Where are you putting your faith? Is it in your bank accounts? Is it in your family? Is it in the NHS? Is it in superstition? Is it your lucky charm? Is it your own brilliance? Is it the brilliance of others? Or do you first and foremost turn to God? So often we rush around and we try and fix things, and only after all else has failed do we think, oh, well, I suppose I could try praying. Let me just say that I think it's great when we get to that point. But it's only great if we genuinely have our faith in the living God. Prayer is completely pointless if you just think you're talking to thin air. You may as well just have a chat to the tree outside. It's pointless. It is only great if we genuinely have our faith in the living God and we trust that He will answer in the right way, in the right time. Sadly, I believe that most people, when they pick up the phone to God, they don't actually expect God to answer. So consequently, the outcome is emptiness and nothingness, because that is exactly what they're expecting. But as James starkly reminds us, a person with divided loyalty is as unsettled as a wave of the sea that is blown and tossed in the wind. Where is your anchor? If you're on the sea, you need one. Or are you just blown and tossed in the wind? It is a wonderful but frightening picture. Have you ever felt like that? You're just being blown from one thing to another. You can't really get your head around everything. Everything is just piling in. I know I felt like that at times. I felt cut adrift. But the truth is, of course, it was me that was adrift and not the Lord. Have you ever cut yourself adrift by making your God too small? Well, verse 7 says, such people should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Their loyalty is divided between God and the world. They are unstable in everything they do. There is no half measure with God. Do you trust Him or don't you? That is some wake-up call, I think. It is pretty stark. James doesn't mince his words. We'll see that as we go through the whole book. It's a big wake-up call. And if it isn't, it should be. Our God is not a tiny, insignificant, made-up idea. There'll be plenty of people who tell you your God's made up. Well, they're the people also alongside us that He created. God is immeasurable. God is eternal. He is incredible. He is all-powerful. He is all-seeing. He is all-knowing. There isn't a place that God isn't. Our God so urgently wants to supply us with everything we need. And if you trust Him first, then seek Him in prayer, and expect Him to respond, then you will know the truth of verse 5. If you need wisdom, ask our generous God, and He will give it to you. There's not a might there, it's a will. Again, if you're a writer in your Bible, feel free to underline that will. And in verse 9 and 10, James follows up the encouragement to pray to our incredible God with a simple statement of fact. And that statement of fact basically says, yes, you will hit the buffers. Yes, you will be deflated. Yes, you will struggle. But Christians, your God is bigger than anything you will ever be faced with. So stop viewing life from a human, tiny, defeatist perspective. Because, you see, whether in the world's eyes you are rich or you are poor is completely irrelevant. It really doesn't matter. Because when you are wholeheartedly living for Jesus, you will want to boast about God. More accurately, in the Greek it says, you will want to, a completely unpronounceable word, I've been struggling with this one all week, it's kochomai. You will want to kochomai. Well, what a weird word. What does that mean? It means give thanks. just as we've been singing, give thanks and rejoice. Rejoice to yourself. Rejoice in your life and rejoice with others that Jesus has saved you and that he is sustaining you and that he is keen to do that for absolutely everyone who would trust him. So there you go. James puts it absolutely on the spot, doesn't he? He says, you're going to go through hassle. You won't enjoy the hassle, and if you are, that's weird. You're going to hit all sorts of things. Some will be big and some will be absolutely insignificant, really, but they'll still bother you. Take the tiny things to the Lord. Take the big things to the Lord. And drop them at his feet. And at that point, rejoice, because you know your prayer will be answered. Let's pray.